Okay, so today I'm going to tell you about, it's going to be primarily an observational talk about some of the constraints that we can bring to bear on accreting black hole systems from the point of view of X-ray spectroscopy. So I'm going to start off with just a general introduction to the subject of X-ray reflection and the production of relativistically broad ion emission lines in X-ray spectra. And then I'm going to spend a little bit of time focusing on the robustness of these lines. This has been an issue of some controversy recently about whether the actual existence of these features in the data are real or not, or whether it's something else we're seeing. So I'm going to address that somewhat and also present results from a new, very deep observation of the Chandra X-ray Observatory, which at least in one object gives us some confidence that we are interpreting the spectrum correctly. I'm going to go on to talk about how we can constrain, in principle, how we can constrain black hole spin from these observations, what's been done in practice so far, and what some of the roadblocks are to actually producing robust constraints on black hole spin, and they're not. Their roadblocks, which in principle can be got around. And then I'll talk a little bit about constraining the physics of the inner accretion disk. John Miller gave a very nice talk on broad lines as well during the conference a couple of weeks ago. I'm going to be talking somewhat about other topics than John covered. John covered especially the phenomenology of these features in galactic black hole candidates and whether they're seen in one state versus another state. I'm not going to be so concerned about that. And primarily I'll be talking about these features in AGN spectra for reasons that will come apparent a little bit later. So what's this X-ray reflection? This is the physical process which is going to give us the features in the spectrum that we're going to be looking at later. So the basic idea is we have a black hole and there's some accretion disk around it which I've shown in cross-section here. And we're talking about luminous objects, not objects such as the galactic center. We're talking about proper luminous objects where there's an optically thick accretion disk. There's a relatively efficient optically thick accretion disk.
And the ones that are rare in the universe.
The ones that are rare in the universe. So we're not talking about your representative black hole system. We're talking about the ones that are easiest to see. Now, somewhere in the system, we know that there is a source of hard X-ray. We see it. We see a hard X-ray emission from the source. And so generically, we might draw a picture like this, where we have some X-ray emitting, this is motivated from the sun, we have some X-ray emitting corona, which sits above and below the disk. That need not necessarily be the geometry. This X-ray source could in fact be in Bernier places. Could be more of a spherical type of arrangement around the black hole. There are ideas where maybe this X-ray source is not really a corona at all, but it's actually the base of a jet. But somewhere in the system we have a source of hard X-rays. And we know that those X-rays basically give us a power law, which is this green line here on this plot. However, some of those X-rays will not come straight out to the observer. They'll actually illuminate the photosphere of this optically thick accretion disk. And you'll get a characteristic spectrum scattered back off the accretion disk, which will have atomic features imprinted in it. We're not talking about a fully ionized accretion disk. The accretion disk, especially in the case of active galactic nuclei, is actually rather cold in these terms. It's 10 to the 5 or so Kelvin. So it has it has many combined species in it.
You still mean it's almost fully ionized.
So it's almost.
Hydrogen and helium are almost pretty well ionized.
Hydrogen and helium are fully ionized, but there are still combined carbon ions, oxygen ions, and in particular, there's a lot of fairly low ionization state iron in the disk. So this is a very simple Monte Carlo calculation, where we've assumed that all the helium and hydrogen is fully ionized, but all the other species are neutral, so that's a toy calculation. And we just Monte Carlo photons falling on that atmosphere, and we see what comes back off. And what comes back off the disk is this red line. So in essence, at high energy, hard X-ray energy, photons are just constant scattered back off the disk. At soft X-ray energy, your average photon is absorbed. That's just photoelectric absorption, boundary absorption. And then there's this spectrum of emission lines that come off. These are fluorescent emission lines. So hard X-ray will knock out one of the inner shell electrons from an ion, and then there'll be the ion will de-excite by an electron from the next shell up, falling down, and that gives you one of these emission models. So generically, you expect the reflection spectrum to give you a hardening at high energies, and then give you this set of emission lines. Now, of course, what we're actually seeing, if the geometry is such as this, we see both the direct emission and the reflected emission added together. We can't spatially separate that off, we see them added together. So we're actually going to see something like this blue line, this top blue line. There's going to be a slight hardening at high energies. There's going to be emission lines. The prevalent emission line is iron, just the combination of the abundance of the element, the high fluorescent yield of the element, just that all adds together to mean that by a long way the prominent emission line is iron.
Is it known whether the source of the X-rays is such that the disk is no less illuminated uniformly?
That's an excellent question.
Could it be in clouds? Or?
We'll come to that a little bit later. That's still very much up in the air, exactly how it's illuminated. And we can start to put constraints on that, which we'll talk about later. In particular, later I'll argue that we can rule out the simple idea that the disk is illuminated according to a Novikov-Thorne accretion disk. We can actually argue against that and start to try to make some inferences from it. Now, of course, this is a very simple toy calculation, particularly a very simple ionization structure. You can do these calculations properly. And there's several codes out there. These are simulations. These are results from Randy Ross's code that David Ballantyne has published a couple of years ago. And this is Lowe's reflection spectra as you turn up the ionization state of the disk. What happens is as you turn up the ionization state of the disk, you're successively ionizing from the Lowe's elements upwards. And that means that your disk becomes quite reflective at the soft X-ray energies because there's no species left down there to actually give you absorption capacity. And eventually, when you go up to very highly ionized disks, you don't get any atomic features.
So this code treats the disk as a uniform box of material, or is it really looking at the pre-processing at a photosphere of the disk?
It's actually radio transfer. So in this particular code, it assumes a constant density atmosphere and just does one-dimensional radio transfer, keeping tracking the ionization equilibrium and the Fermi equilibrium at each.
The column density of this layer is a variable that you can tune also?
You're trying to model the atmosphere of this. So you actually just make this layer so thick that you hope that you're insensitive to your lower boundary emission, and you're following the reflection of radiation coming in the top.
So this column density has been set high enough that X-rays are Thompson scattered back out again?
Yeah. In these actual calculations, it follows in detail five Thompson depths, and then it has just some boundary emission at the bottom to try to soak up anything that makes it.
That the incident radiation is also taken into account in calculating the thermal ionization structure. Yep. In addition, there's a source of flux.
In addition, there's a source of flux, a source of thermal flux coming up from the bottom. So these particular calculations are constant density calculations because, in essence, you can map the problem just to an optical depth. So in essence, what you assume about the density structure isn't particularly important. Modulo the fact that if you actually look at if you look at proper hydrostatic models of this, you can actually get a thin layer on top subject to thermal instability. And so you can get a highly ionized layer sitting on top, which can somewhat dilute your signatures from just the constant scatter back.
Collisional processes are not important at all?
They are important in establishing the equilibrium at different levels. Extended collision process. I'm not sure. I have to check the details of this graph.
Well, you can keep the density also just from doing ionization equilibrium. Is doing the ionization equilibrium doing that, I need to be wondering about it.
Yes, so...
So you do need to know the density just to get the recombination rate.
Yeah, because essentially you can scale and you can just set your ionization parameter. So what you would be doing is as you, if you were to map from one density structure to the other density structure, you would just be change scaling your flux. So you have a constant ionization parameter.
Via the ionization surface.
Okay, so there are examples of ionized calculations. Now, I'm just going to briefly show a couple of very mundane examples of this in nature, just so you can see that I'm not completely making up stories. This is the cold fluorescent line from the photosphere of the sun, okay. A very old observation, in the mid-80s. So in the solar flare... That's not very dramatic of me. In the subject
of older than you, scientific.
The subject of X-ray astronomy. This is before the current generation of X-ray.
It's not very up to now. It's not. Never mind. The point is good.
So here we have the cold fluorescent line scattered to the photosphere of the sun, ion line scattered to the photosphere of the sun during a solar flare. Intrinsically very narrow, just a couple of hundred kilometers per second broad. This is an example of a narrow ion fluorescence line actually in a SAFER 2 galaxy. So this is, you have a hard X-ray source, which is the actual nucleus itself. And this is X-ray reflection off the surface of some molecular torus, or some distribution of cold matter that's enshrouding this this active nucleus. And you can, and this is a Chandra grating observation, so very high resolution. You can actually go in and measure which ionization state you're looking at. So this particular line is consistent with cold ion, and you can, in principle, be sensitive to the whole slew of ionization states. That's that for the people who know terminology. That's the ion K alpha line. That's the ion K beta line. Is actually two lines there.
What's your limit on the temperature of the reflection?
To get that cold, I think it's some. I think it's something in the order of 10 to the 5. I promise that you, I think it's that order. And this is an, oops. That's not right. This is a SAFER 1 galaxy, so this is where we're looking at the AGN unobscured. And again, we find a narrow line consistent with cold ion. Now, one reason to put this plot up is to show you that, you know, these lines do exist. Another reason to put this plot up, which is going to be relevant for later on, the rest of the spectrum here is actually fit with the power law. That's it, just the power law. So in AGN, at least, there are many examples where a straight power law is a good description of this part of the spectrum. And you can actually understand that fairly easily because there's a very large separation in energy scales. This is thermal quantization. Your seed photons are down in the UV band, and the corona, this hot distribution of electrons, is actually reducing the quantization, is up at, you know, with a temperature of 10 to the 8 or so, 10 to the 9, sorry, Kelvin, which is, corresponds to KT of 100 KV. So in this energy band, which is well away from both boundaries, you actually would expect to form a very nice power law, and that's what you see. I saw one or two little frowns, probably because this isn't actually a straight line or log-log plot. That's because I'm doing the standard X-ray thing, and this is a folded spectrum, okay? So this has the instrument response multiplied into it, which is why it looks like that. Okay, so let's come to the main topic of the talk, which is these lines from the disk. So we have this strong emission line, and if it's produced from the surface layers of an accretion disk, then we can work out the Doppler shift and gravitational redshift effects on that line profile. And this particular audience, I don't need to labor this in any detail, just to say that you end up with a line which is broad, primarily through Doppler effects. It's skewed such that typically the blue peak of the line is higher than the red peak of the line, primarily through relativistic aberration effects. And typically the whole line is somewhat downshifted, somewhat redshifted, which is primarily due to gravitational redshifting effects. So the standard assumptions always made in this field, and in principle could be challenged, is that we assume a flat Keplerian disk. And for a flat Keplerian disk, the profile of the line is determined by two scalars and a free function. It's determined by the inclination of the accretion disk, A over M of the black hole, and a function which tells you how the line production changes a function of radius. And then, of course, there's a trivial free parameter, which is the absolute position line, the absolute energy of the line. And that's all that determines the profile of the line. So it's not masses of free parameters. Now, briefly show you some of the...
This epsilon is the line emissivity or the...
It's the line emissivity. So, you know, how many line photons per proper unit time, per proper unit surface area of the disk are coming out. So let me briefly show you some of the sort of average the data for objects that have these, well, not necessarily average, but these are some of the AGM which show some of these broad lines. I'm going to show you the really nice example in a bit. But you can see that there are these lines appearing in the data. Now, to actually make these figures, of course, you have to continue to subtract. And that's a little bit of trickery, which I'm going to, you know, open the box and show you a little bit in a minute. So you have to continue to subtract, and that's where a lot of the arguments have been about. But if you believe the continuous subtraction in these particular figures, then there's a broad line there, there, and there. So those features are actually present in the data.
Can I ask a naive question?
Yeah.
Why is it we see this MCG 52316, I mean, since 1995? Is it brighter, or what's so special about it?
You mean 6315, actually.
Yes. I think, Jim, this is another object. It's a somewhat separate object.
That's not it.
Yeah, that's not it. That's not it. The answer to the question of why the one I'm about to show you has so much nicer data is that, firstly, it is one of the objects that displays these lines. Not all of them do. I showed you an example just a few slides ago, which was an object with a very nice power along just a narrow line. So there's a limited class of objects that show these lines. And then also that object's just been done to death, just been observed many, many, many times. So it's very bright. It's interestingly variable. Mm-hmm. So you can try to go after various variability characteristics, and it displays one of these.
You put up a big neon sign saying, here, come look at me.
Bright and interestingly variable. I wish I could say that about myself.
Okay, so that's AGN. Now, galactic black hole candidates also display features in this part of the spectrum. John Miller has done tremendous amount of work in pulling these features out of the spectrum. There's a whole different set of systematics that come into play here. The continuum you're subtracting is much more complex. You have a thermal component, you know, the thermal emission from the accretion disk is no longer in the UV band, it's in the X-ray band. Okay? So you have a fairly complicated continuum you're trying to subtract off. On the other hand, you might suspect that some of the absorption problems you get into an AGM might not be present here. Chris will disagree with that. I'm not going to necessarily get into that controversy.
These spectra look very broad, which is presumably because of the Doppler.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But another possibility is that it's not the iron line. How do you know it's an iron line when it isn't something else which is broad?
That's a good question. So, because I was going to get into that in my next slide. So there's actually been a whole industry about trying to assess the robustness of these lines. I mean, talk to this while I put this up. So this is one of the nicest examples of these lines. And you can imagine many different lines of attack on this. you know, maybe this entire feature isn't iron, it's just something else. The continuum is intrinsically curved, or there's absorption in the spectrum which is giving you curvature. That's one particular line of attack. The absorption is a real possibility, which I'm going to speak to in a minute. Other possibilities, you just have to do it. You just have to calculate what those curved spectra would look like, or you know, possible classes of curved spectra, compare them to the data, and just you know, see if they work or not. And in some objects, they do. But in some, such as this, they don't.
I think the trouble in the continuums and traps just down to 3 keV is very difficult to interpret from the audience point of view.
In the very next slide, I'll do something which was never done. I'll show you the full spectrum. And it will help actually make your point. So that's that. The other thing you might do is say, okay, suppose this is iron. Suppose we are seeing an iron line. What else could broaden the line? And when they were first actually seen in Exosat data of Cygnus X1, these features, there was a suggestion that maybe it was Compton broadening. So basically these nine photons are just rattling around. Every time they're rattling around, they lose some energy to recoil. And that's what broadens your line. In some settings, that might work. It turns out you just can't make that work and produce a downscattered line this broad. You just need the parameters of the Compton cloud would require, you need it to be completely ionized so the lines don't get absorbed, and you need to be very cold because you need downscattering, you need many scatterings to do that. And you can fold in constraints of variability time scales, and that doesn't work. So if people are interested, I can point them, I can speak more, point them at literature about that. I wasn't going to necessarily get too much into dragging you through the fairly boring process of nailing alternative model after alternative model.
Does it matter if the continuum didn't represent a Compton cloud? To take the minority view that it might be a parabola, might be a non-thermal thing coming from the base of the jet or some such thing?
It would only matter to the extent that it would make it significantly deviate from power. So if you could produce a spectrum which had very strong curvature, then yes, that would start to.
Right, but the observations are those very parallel, like at least to get out to 120 degrees.
Okay, now.
Can't do that. Minority or majority view, you can't play that game very easily.
Yeah. And of course, I've shown a restricted part of the data, there is more data, and many observations also have contemporaneous RXTE data, which push it out to 20 or 30 kV, so we can try to look at that. It's hard.
What's the continuum flux here? So you have 6 times 10 minus 4?
So this is about 10% feature in the continuum. Okay, now the one remaining difficulty, or the one remaining alternative model, which I can say is the one that made me worry in terms of interpreting this data, was an absorption model. It is possible, then we put this up and see why I'm worried. I'm going to show you the rest of the spectrum, and that's what the rest of the spectrum is. What's this thing here? Well, that's the warm absorber, which has been known about for a long time. Did my PhD thesis in the warm absorber. It's probably... it's almost certainly photo-ionized gas along the line of sight to the central engine. Probably a wind that we're seeing. It's probably a photo-ionized wind from maybe the accretion disk or maybe the molecular torus or some other structure. So, its origin is not important. But there's this enormous bite taken out of the spectrum. And in this line, this model fit here, all I did is take this whole spectrum and just blindly fit a double warm absorber model to it, so assume that you've got two characteristic zones. And you see you actually fit this end very nicely. You obviously don't explain this part well, but in principle you can see that the absorption can actually cut in and take up a lot of the very highly redshifted parts of your line. And obviously the very highly redshifted part is the most interesting part.
The features around 4 keV look nominally very significant. What are they?
So we would argue that they are features in the iron line, actually where iron line slope changes, but it's always a model training, then you say what they are. Okay, now just to give you some idea of, I mean, clearly,
sorry, about 3 keV? See, I mean, I'm just wondering, is there someone I would identify with absorption and then at some point you transition and identify with?
In this particular spectrum, I wouldn't take any of the sharp features that seriously. There's the resolution.
But, I mean, is it grossly oversampled? Because you can see like 20 points.
Yes, it is grossly oversampled. Okay, so obviously there's obviously some iron line. Maybe it's a narrow line, but it's obviously a feature there. So I'm going to show you this plot again, but I'm just not going to include that part of the data in doing the fix, just to give you some slightly better idea of what the underlying warm sort of model may be. And that's what you'd get if you just cut out this part of the spectrum when you're doing the fix. So you can see that it's hard. I mean, I'm just showing you a general, not showing you anything detailed yet. But
you're actually cutting from 3 to 8 kilovolts, right? Not just.
Yes. Sorry. Okay. I'm cutting from 3 to 8.
So what are those different colors again? Now I'm confused.
Red is data. Green is a model. So if you cut from 3 to 8, which is nominally where Andy Faye and I would say that the line is. So this is a cheat, then you can see that the Warm-Zorb model leaves an excess there, which maybe is what we want to interpret as the line. So let's try and do something that
so
is...
This is just a line component.
It's a two-component Warm-Zorb, so... Which is what you need to get the details of down here right. You don't have two components, you don't get the details of the high signals and noise part of the spectrum down here.
So the points from 8 to 10 keV are included in the fit.
They are included. So you see the fit's trying to bend down. It still can't quite hit those points.
Well, that means that those planets, which I think you're going to say are absorbed by bound-free continuum of iron on the right, is that why those are depressed or not?
No, I'm actually going to, in the end, I'm going to argue that pretty much.
So the fact that model over predicts that forces the model in the 5 keV region to go down.
Correct. Yes.
And that prevents it from chewing up more of the iron.
So, this, you know, something you may have heard before, but this is one demonstration of it, is that your signal up here is crucial to what you're trying to do. You have to see. And this is why XMM is actually so much better than ASCO for doing this. You have to see the spectrum up here to be able to really do anything with this. Now, there's obviously something complicated going on here. So let's ask a slightly simpler question. What I'm going to do is to throw away the soft part of the spectrum, throw away everything below, I think, 2 or 3 kV. And I'm going to say, okay, can we fit and throw away the obvious line? Can we fit what's left with the Warm-Zorb? The answer is obviously going to be yes, we can. So ignoring that part of the spectrum, and that is an absorber fit to these data. And physically, what's happening here is that this part of the spectrum, which we would like to interpret as the very strong redshifted wing of the line. The curvature there is being completely taken up by the absorber. In detail, it's actually INL absorption. There are ionization states of iron, which they're bound, their L shell bound free edges give you that curvature. Now you can also see.
Even that one suffers from the fact that the right hand is brought down points that it obviously is not going to fit. If it's not going to fit them at all, well, I don't know. It's not obvious that you should put them in because that's going to again bring down the model.
In this fit, I don't include anything in this.
Right, above 8, I mean.
Yeah. Now you can see, if you look in the shaded region, you can see that the actual K shell edge is quite high up because it's an ionized gas. But this is the important point which I'm starting to drive towards now, is that if you actually try and soak up all of this red wing of the line by curvature from the absorber here, you necessarily actually predict a rather deep absorption line there. This is the absorption line of the very species that's giving you this curvature. This is the K-shell absorption line of the species whose L-shell edges are giving you that curvature.
What do you put in for the width of the K-shell absorption?
It's assumed now.
It's assumed to be?
I think we put in 100 kilometers per second.
So. Okay. Now that can have a big effect on the equivalent width of the line.
But it will only ever make you, you know, only make the equivalent width higher.
So your equivalent width is essentially zero.
Yeah. No. What do you mean equivalent width?
Or it's 100 dB. I mean the equivalent width, as the total width goes to zero in these nebular conditions, the equivalent width. I mean as the total.
Well, you
as the velocity width goes to zero, the equivalent width goes to zero under these nebular conditions.
Yeah, but it has the thermal width in as a minimum, and then we specify an additional turbulent broadening of something small, like 100 kilometers per second.
Okay, I'm sorry to go back to this, but around 4 keV, we kind of understand those baby wiggles in order to form an opinion on any of this. Those big
don't
wiggles,
have to understand the wiggle description for me, but
I mean, those are big amplitude wiggles compared to, say, the red wing, and it's comparable to the red wing of the line. And they're going up and down, you know, and our eyes cannot assess the signal to noise at all if you say it's grossly oversampled. So I would be very uncomfortable with trying to interpret this picture.
I don't be too worried about these windows.
Why?
Because I mean, look at the actual statistical, the actual percentage deviation of the line. I mean, you're talking about.
But it's not that different from that 5.5 keV where the putative red wing is.
You're jumping.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm setting this up for something to come.
Okay.
So don't worry too much about this because I'm going to kill this.
Okay.
We're trying to see.
Interpretation. I think I have to understand that to warm the
We're trying to see if we can get rid of this red wing, the general curvature of this red wing, from the absorber model. And the point is that the you get an absorption line from the same species to give you the curvature. You blow that up just to show you. It's actually a set of absorption lines from the individual species, the individual higher species that are present at that time. So, how can we go after this? Well, obviously, we look for this absorption. That's an important diagnostic of whether this absorber model is correct. You can't do that with the XMM data that I was showing you, because the spectral resolution just isn't enough. The absorption lines are all blotted out. So,
excuse me, where would the absorber be, right? And would it be above the disk?
Where these will be? It would be some, I mean, we're looking at the system, we have a black hole and disk, and there is some wind, some disk wind coming off the system. And we do actually see winds at other parts of the spectrum, so the proof of principle is there that these winds exist. It's a question of whether they have the right state to do this. So this is a hard thing to do. You need high spectral resolution data, and you need actually fairly high signal-to-noise data. To this end, we secured a little over 500,000 seconds of channel to go after this. And this is actually the result. So this is that particular part of the Chandra grating spectrum. And I'll show you some of the features to do detect in a second. But this red line here, apologies if it's a little faint, but this line here is actually just the prediction from that previous model overlaid on here. We clearly don't see that absorption line. Clear absence of that absorption line there. What do we see in the spectrum? We see an emission line there. That's actually consistent with the cold emission line of iron, neutral iron.
So you can take the blue one away.
I guess I believe you. Presumably there's some material large distance producing that line. We see that is the rest frame power. That's the rest frame energy of helium-like iron. We don't see anything there, but we do see something there. You see an absorption line there, a weak absorption line. And that's the rest frame energy of the galaxy of hydrogen-like iron, iron 26. Again, we don't see anything there, but we do see something there. These look like they are fairly faint absorption lines from very highly ionized iron in a wind that's coming out of the, it's flowing out by a couple of thousand kilometers per second.
The equivalent width of those features is less than we were needing to explain the curvature of
the equivalent width is less, but more importantly, they just took the, they are helium and hydrogen-like species, which don't, which don't have any iron L
absorption.
So this is very important on space, because I think this really nails one of the main predictions of that absorption model. It's hard to get around this. Now, this took a long time with Chandra on this bright object. So, and for this one object, I think we can use this as convincing, as a convincing argument against the absorber model. What you'd like to do is to generalize this to many objects. We can't do that with Chandra. Haven't got enough months and year to give away of Chandra time to do this. However, Asteroid will be launched next month, pretty much exactly a month from now, I think. And this should, this is a glimpse of what Asteroid should be able to do on a fairly routine basis in other objects. So the field may move forward in this respect.
How do we know the absorption isn't being filled in by KRP emission?
So that is the, you can imagine, there's K alpha emission, just the right strength. And if it's within, let's try and give the resolutions. If it's within about 500 kilometers per second at the same velocity, that might fill it in. So again, Asteroid will tell us whether that's the case, because it will have much better resolution. And if you start seeing no features in that part of the spectrum, it starts becoming just too much of a contrivance to make the emission field the absorption across all parts of the spectrum.
So what happened to the big broad line in this? Is it just a different state?
It's this big.
But why is it not? It just fits in the...
Spectral resolution will show you broad features, because they're broader than what you're showing there.
The broad line goes down to like here.
Yeah, the full width at half max wasn't that big, was it?
So you're saying there's a peak?
Well, I thought so based on that other line.
It's probably counts per second.
Yeah, it's not a ratio.
And look at the error bars on this. So it's, that's broad features in a high resolution spectral are lost in the noise. If you bin this up, I mean, if you're interested, this was on AstroPH yesterday, if you actually bin the spectrum up, degrade the resolution, you recover the broad line. Actually, it's very consistent with XML. If you downgrade the resolution and add all the sync noise and things.
So you said that you had a model for the double component absorption, which you are discarding, but there are other. There's another form of which you are not discovering, which maybe means some of the
hieroglyphics. I'm sorry.
You're showing us features that you say are consistent with the wind, a couple of thousand kilometers. So that's a separate form of absorption type that you call than the ones that you both showed in your model.
So you're saying that maybe this line is elsewhere?
No, I'm asking you. So you're
asking. It's not a story.
I thought you said that what you're seeing you can interpret also as a warm absorption, but different from the one you postulated.
You mean this here, yes. These lines here? Yes, different ionization state, a different physical state to that we need for the broad line. And actually it shows up, basically doesn't show up in any waveband apart from these subtle lines there.
Yeah, it's not so warm.
It's a not so warm, it's a pretty hot warm absorber. PHW. Okay, let me move on. I have to skip some stuff and move on to black hole spin. So we have this broad feature. Now I'm going to assume that we have this broad feature without
So you can leave us hanging, but you described your double worm server model.
Oh, so they leave you hanging. So the model now, or the picture now, is that the warm absorber that we would require to make that warming go away, it can't be there. So we obviously have the colder warm absorber that we need to make the soft liquid spectrum work. And we have this very hot fluff out here.
Okay.
But the rest of the spectrum, we think we can interpret as taking that continuous attracting off and the broad lines robust.
So you have cold, you have pretty hot, but you don't have in between.
Which actually fits in with thermal instability.
Mm-hmm.
It's in what time? It fits in with the thermal of the S curve. My computer's being slow today. Okay, let's move to black hole spin. So how can we probe black hole spin? How does it affect? Well, obviously it affects photon trajectories because you're probing this system through photon trajectories. More importantly, it affects the disk structure. And this is actually the main thing that you're looking at when you look at Einstein profiles of function of spin. And the principal effect seems to be, or the principal effect is on disk structure, that any most stable circular orbit shrinks as you increase the spin of the black hole. This is a very simple plot showing you how the line profile would change if you took a disk with a certain fixed power law emissivity from the, as a function of radius, from the ISCO outwards. And the only effect you're seeing here is as you spin the hole up, you bring the inverse stable circular orbit in. So obviously you can see now the importance of trying to go for the broadest lines we can and why it's very important to try to assess the robustness of that very highly redshifted stuff in MSG6 that I was just looking at. Because it's from the highly redshifted stuff you're going to get constraints on, for example, the spin of the black hole. Now, let's make the first step. And let's assume that the region inside the ISCO, the region inside the most stable circular orbit, is irrelevant for producing observational signatures. This is actually is a fairly common assumption to make. So you can clearly now, if you look for the maximal detected redshift of your feature, then that tells you something about how deep into the potential you're going, so you can get a lower bound than what the spin is, spin of the black hole. The black hole could always be more rapidly spinning because you could always truncate the disk further away in the scope, but it'll give you a lower bound on the spin of the hole. So this is one sequence of fits that my graduate student, Laura Brennan, did, where she took, she constructed a model of these relative emission lines as a function, and she had the spin parameter of the hole, there's a tunable parameter in there, and she went through and fit these lines to the MSG6 data with all of the other, the continuum uncertainties and all the other model parameters being marginalized over. Okay, so
what's the lag?
That's the spin parameter of the hole.
No, lag.
You can't read this, can you? Chi-squared. This is chi-squared enough bit. 200, 400, 600, 800. Away from the minimum. So delta chi-squared.
Starting triggering the reflected continuum as well.
This doesn't include the reflected continuum.
What are the parameters that go into the fit? For example, is the inclination?
So in here, the inclination's in there. We assume the emissivity is, we have a broken power law form for emissivity as a function of radius from the disk, and the parameters that are broken power law are all free parameters, so the two indices plus the break radius plus the inner radius, these are all free parameters in the problem, and they're marginalized over in determining this chi-square.
The inclination, the mass, and
So the mass is not a parameter in the problem because the whole thing scales as the gravitational radius. As long as you phrase all your distances in terms of gravitational radius, it's not a parameter.
Thanks.
So you can see that the low spin solutions are very strongly disfavored, delta chi-squared of 600. And you can see it's getting the spectrum wrong. There's huge broad residuals in the spectrum with such a large delta chi-squared. As you spin up, of course, it gets a better and better fit. And formally, and I will stress that this is formally, so don't take me to task on these numbers too much. If you zoom up on this high spin part, so this curve really shot up here, you can say that the spin is greater than about 0.91. That's setting your formal statistical limit on it. That's assuming that you've got that you describe the spectrum with the, exactly the correct model, and you take all your statistical the errors to be statistical errors. So clearly, we have a lot of diagnostic power on the spin. It's a question of whether we're getting that right. Now, the major uncertainty, in my opinion, on this whole process is the contribution from the region inside the ISCA. Not to say that the analysis we just did, just to answer criticism, but Chris is going to get me on, not to say the analysis we just did is the final word on this, we should include reflection as well. Mm-hmm. It's going to change things quantitatively, but not qualitatively. We still have this very broad feature to model, and we still need a high spin to do it. However, of course, all we're really doing here is detecting the ISCO. We're not really saying actually much about the spin of the hole. We're not detecting characteristic, relativistic features of the spin of the hole. We're just detecting the ISCO. So if you can get line emission from the ISCO, from inside the ISCO, things change, things weaken, actually. And, you know, it's a trivial point, which is actually still worth making. You can get arbitrarily large redshifts from around a spatial black hole, as long as you're allowed to put your emission anywhere you want. So the factor of a very broad line doesn't really tell you anything. That's good. How can you get line emission from inside the ISCO? Well, all you need are the following conditions. You need the optical depth to be greater than 1, and it actually surprises a lot of the observational side of my community when I tell them that's satisfied easily, trivially, by mass continuity, just by solving the continuity equation of a fixed m dot. That's solved for anything higher than about 10%
NETV.
What's
MCD, sir?
What's the
editing
ratio?
20 or 30. We don't know the mass, so we don't, I can't give you a hard number, but it's in the ballpark 20 or 30. So that's easy to satisfy. The harder one is you need that region not to be fully ionized. As the material, as the radial velocity picks up, then gained by continuity, the density from it, so your ionization parameter, as long as you're radiated, is going to shoot up as you go in. But it's uncertain, but it's actually quite plausible to have a low enough ionization parameter to still get some features, down to, in a spatial case, maybe about 4.5 m. When these goes at 6 m. And that's actually a long way in. That's actually increases your redshift by quite a lot. And then you need that region to be illuminated somehow to get these features to come out.
So the idea here is that as you move in, the density goes up?
Yeah, down. The radial velocity is increasing.
So then, what is it, an upper limit?
That's what you need to be able to get any emission out. So let me show you a plot. So that's for a typical case, I think that's 10% NETs. That's the optical depth, it's a function of radius, drops obviously because the density is dropping. This is for some assumed parameters, the ionization parameter. As you go in, the ionization parameter increases because your material is becoming much less dense.
I mean, the answer is probably easy, but it's obvious that it makes ionization improvement.
That's not obvious at all.
Spiraling.
Yeah. In this model, it's spiraling.
Yeah. Some source. And
so the velocity field, which is just it's the orbits with the energy and angular momentum of the ISCO, which is spiraling.
Chris, what do you make the opposite assumption? You assume that all the stuff you're seeing is coming from inside this ISCO.
Well, then you actually have problems because your line is too broad. In start getting into details. It depends on the state of the object you're looking at. Okay? In some states, you can do that. In other states, you actually need stuff from further out because you have some sharp horn or so on your line. You need to have some material further out, or some mission further out to do that. Just to show you the effects this have in this simple model that Mitch and myself made a few years ago, the dashed lines here are not including mission from within the ISCO, and the solid lines are. This is for a choice of parameters that maximizes the effect, and this is for a choice of parameters that in some sense reduce this difficulty. So you see, it can have a major effect of giving you broad red tails on these lines. Now, to briefly say, the first application of this, which was actually quite successful, was to the deep minimum state, the so-called deep minimum state of energy minus 615. In this object, so this is the long ASCO observation that produced the original broad line, the original relativistic line. And at the very end of this observation, it went into this low flux state. And during that time, the line became very broad, produced that. And the original application of these models of emission within ISCO showed that you could actually explain those very data with a spatial black hole, contrary to the claims before by Iwasawa et al. And this is how you do it. So you have a spatial black hole, and you illuminate it just by putting a point source on the axis. Well, it's unjustified, but let's just do it anyway. Put a point source on the axis, and if you move that point source from 12m to 4m above the disk, then you change the line profile from that to that. And that's what the hole displays most times. That's what it displays during the deep minimum. All spatial stuff, so it didn't mean spin. Furthermore, actually, as you lower the source, your source appears dimmer because all the photons are being bent away from you, and that actually explains the drop in flux.
So how does the location of the source figure in here exactly? What calculation is
it? How does the location of the source figure in? It just gives you different illumination patterns on the disk.
So you actually calculate the trajectories and then the intensity and the energy of the photons that arrive at the disk?
As you lower the source towards the horizon, the irradiation of that region of the disk becomes stronger and stronger, yet less photons. Now, what about the current data? I'll skip over this, is obvious. Applying these same models to the current data, the current XMM data, we can still fit the spectrum with a non-spinning hole. However, here we need essentially all of the emission to be concentrated at 3m, again, with the ISCO at 6m. This is, quotes, not plausible. I can't imagine a disk where you can do this. However, and this is now a plea to anybody here who wants to take this problem on, that's a somewhat weak statement because we actually don't have, the model that I presented for the region side ISCO still is about the only one you can use to actually figure into these models. And it's very crude. We need a better model of the plunge region. I mean, is this really impossible? Is it impossible to have all the emission at 3m? Until we can really answer that question, I think we can't make progress with the strain of the spin of the holes from this technique. But it would seem like this is a doable thing, just predicts the run of ionization states as you go in the plunge region. And if that's doable, then it's doable.
But it sounds like it's also crucial that you get the X-ray radiation correct.
So it's always going to be in the context of a model for where your source is.
So is the source still sitting there above the disk in the illumination source? And you say his last couple of lines here?
This
the emission concentrated in 3M.
No.
You're also illuminating from somewhere.
Sorry, so this is just parameterizing the emission. So I don't care about where your primary source is now. I just say, okay, I'm assuming that my lines are coming from the disk, parameterized in such a way. So I try to remove that model.
I have a question. No. All these features are, your arrow lines are always there when you go and put them? I mean, is this source persistent?
Yes, this source is persistent. The Glatzblatt candidates are a very different issue. There it comes and goes. Most of the AGN, which in the AGN I had to put up with the only one to talk, they always show these features.
Okay, so whatever is the source, so it's not like a flare or.
It's not just a
transient. We make it leak for a better model. I mean, there's a parameter which is the clamping factor. So if you have clamping, you could.
Yes.
So that's.
You could.
So it would be hard to model. I mean, it would still be some arbitrary.
Yeah. Okay, so that's where I want to leave off the work on constraining the spin.
Can I just ask one question about that?
Yes,
I mean,
sorry.
Do you ever fit your model, I mean, let's assume nothing is coming from the ISCO. Do you ever fit your models to A or M much bigger than one and get an upper?
No, we don't. No, I know where that question's coming from.
Cosmic censorship is still a conjecture in general relativity.
That would be interesting to do.
Run the computer program and just see what.
That would be interesting.
Can you argue vehemently in favor of
it's a theory. How do you know it's right? That's right. Well, I mean, we need information. We just had a talk with Peter on the other day. Well, very strong evidence.
And, I mean, I haven't spent much time thinking about this, but in principle, you might think the lines would then become narrower again because there's no infinite redshift surface. There's no horizon.
Your intuition is stronger than mine.
I might be wrong, but it would be interesting parameter space to at least look at. So let me end up by talking about the physics of the inner disk, and I know I'm approaching time, so I'll try to make this brief. What can we say about I've spoken about the spin of the hole and told you where I think, giving my honest opinion of where I think we're at with that. What can we say about the physics of the accretion disk itself? Well, this is the XMM spectrum of that deep minimum state, the XMM spectrum of that very broad line that I spoke about earlier. And the line here is, this now has all the reflection folded into it, because ionized reflection. This line here is the model fit to the so-called standard accretion disk, the Novikov, Thorne, and Page and Thorne accretion disk model around a rapidly spinning A of 0.998 black hole. And you can see that even though in some sense we've maximized out the spin, even going to A of 1 won't really change much, we've maximized out the spin, we still have a line that's not broad enough. So, and this, like I said, this has now at best has a Warm Zorba model in, so we try to explain that curvature in the spectrum. And
can you elaborate on why that doesn't fit a little better?
The redshift's just that.
No, I mean, looking at the figure, I'm not seeing what's failing to fit.
The line comes down there, the data are all up here.
Just worried about whether this is statistically, the line is statistically far from where the points are.
The
difference real.
The plot I'll show you later, which has a model that does fit, is the formal difference in the goodness of fit. The chi squared is 100, which is actually very significant.
So when you say reflection tracks dissipation, I thought the input was that the flux input in changes the local conditions.
I'm just trying to start a simple question, which is, can you fit the data from the model where, for example, you have a local corona, you have a thin corona, so there's no light bending effects, whose power output is proportional to the dissipation of the light disk?
But if you put a source above the disk, you would still
change it. I'm trying to set up a simple question, and it turns out that it doesn't work.
Does that have your Hotting number in it?
No, this doesn't have this. Hot absorbers only, we installed it a couple months ago, so this is even interesting. This is Novikov and Thorne dissipation law. It peaks at about 1.5 and then goes to zero at the ISCO, it's because by assumption there is a zero torque boundary emission at the ISCO. You assume there's no stresses, the accretion disk, and therefore no dissipation at the ISCO. And so, you know, it's turnover that's giving us the problems. We're not getting enough fresh emission. You just do a straight parallel fit to those data, you get R minus 4.5. So there's been two lines of attack on this problem, and they're both, to be honest, obviously, they're both right at some level. One which Andy Fabian's group has explored, and is a little bit more developed because Andy has 10 times more manpower than I do, is that assume the disks are, the underlying disk is a simple Nabokov form like this, but the X-ray reflection doesn't track the local dissipation. In particular, Andy explores the idea, again, we have a source at high latitude and let light bending do all the work for you. The other idea, the other extreme of this, suppose reflection does track the dissipation of the disk, but you've got deviations from the so-called standard disk. And this is the idea that my group has been exploring. But like I say, really, nature's almost certainly got both of these issues going on. To briefly touch on on each of those two topics, one approach which is motivated by both some analytic and some numerical theory is a way of changing the dissipation law away from Nabokov form by actually torquing the inner edge of the disk magnetically. So Charles has done work on this, Julian Krolik has done work on this, and Lee has also done a lot of work on this. If you just take a simple disk model and you turn a torque on at the inner edge, then in fact the work done by that torque actually comes out in some finite range of radii like that. It's viscously transported out, so this is just a simple viscous disk. And you can say, okay, suppose this is going on, how much of this torque do I need to explain the spectrum? And you can code that up and fit it to your data. This again is Nabokov-Thorne, and this is what you get if you turn that torque on to actually a rather large value. It's definitely a better fit. And statistically, it's delta chi-squared about 100. It pushes you into an uncomfortable region of parameter space. You go to a so-called, what Agon and Krolik call an infinite efficiency disk, meaning that the disk is shining almost entirely because of the torque, because of the work done by the torque on the inner edge. So that's that makes it
or something around 5 is the point around 6 7 4 6.
Yeah, also
the other one.
Oh, that?
Yes.
Yeah.
It is significant from here.
Your point is right. So that gives us that, you know, maybe that's that kind of thing is going on. I mean, again, you know, it's one of these things. We have the diagnostic power to see this. The question is disentangling it from the other things. And then the second.
So you're saying it's not good enough? I guess
I'm saying that, like I say, we have the data at the point where it's sensitive to these effects. The remaining question is how to separate these all out. The other
is this is still completely turned off the region inside the ISCO.
Yes. So this actually wasn't one of the slides I skipped. So this still assumes the region inside the ISCO is a dead region. And again, to make this, to really strengthen this up, we have to match that on. It's unreasonable to have an emissivity which cusps up and bang, it turns off. So that has to be turned on. The other model, which Andy's group's been leading, has been looking at light. So I'm now showing you some slides that from Andy, is looking at the light bending in these systems. And it's actually kind of cute that there may be features in the data that support this kind of idea. One thing Andy's been doing is looking in detail at the time variability of these spectral features. So I won't labor the details, but basically you can take the data, you can carve it up by how bright the source is, and you can look at how these features change the function of how bright the source is. And in fact, what you actually find is kind of a curious thing. You find the spectrum kind of decomposes into a case where you have a fairly stable reflection component, which has all the broadening in it. And then you have a variable power law component. By looking at the time change, the time variability spectrum, you can decompose it in that manner. For example, you could take two spectra from different times, different flux states, and subtract them. If you subtract them, all you get left is the power law.
You get the power law, but without any line emission.
Without some line emission.
Or reflection or any where
it's not that good.
But that's
So
the non-response of the line to the continuum change is, you know, I'd love to hear your opinions on that.
Let me finish this up then. So what you can actually do is that actually does fall out from the following idea. You have your point. You have your point source again. You actually may just assume this point source is a constant luminosity. Let's start moving it around. Then, as you move it around, you decrease. If you move it down, for example, you decrease what you see. You increase illumination of the disk. So there's obviously going to be some decoupling of the continuum you see from the continuum that illuminates the disk. And if you compute that through, you get this. That's the response of the ion line, and that's the response of the power law component to the height of the source that you have. So then you can sort of plot the flux of the line to the flux of the power law component, which is really what you're seeing in the data, and you get something that looks like that. It's actually fairly flat over a certain range of fluxes because the because of a cancellation of the effects you're seeing, moving the source down and increasing the radiation of this. And these are the data. I mean, this is from Andy's observation. This is from my observation. So maybe we're reproducing that. So it's kind of interesting that their model does give you this proportionality of the line flux and the continuing flux at low energy. It would be nice for one person to actually make this plot rather than combine data from two people with different opinions on these things.
That plot has no axes on top, but it looks like they're, what's that blow up? I mean, that can, must be, this where's the zero on that? Is it logarithmic or?
The zero is actually there on this plot. I made this particular one, sorry.
So we can't relate that one to this one and show the continuity.
So
the little box and the big box are not in any way,
They're matched up. They're matched up in it's just really these axes should have been drawn up like that. They are actually matched.
And these are that's a linear
plot. Okay, so I've already gone over time, so let me skip straight to the end. So what's the bottom lines here? I think there are robust examples of these ion emission lines in most rigid disks. Now, if you are, I think this is where it depends whether you take a physics approach or an astronomy approach. If you're a physicist, having just one or two of these lines, which you honestly truly believe in, is great, because you can then go and study your black holes using these lines. As an astronomer, you want to use these lines to investigate, you know, what the demographics of objects in the universe are like. So whether the astronomers are going to be happy is unclear yet. Otherwise, how common these lines are is not yet clear. And that, hopefully, we'll have a lot more data on that when ASTRO-E starts operating. Line profiles are sensitive to black hole spin, and I think modulo some extreme model for the plunge region, which can really get emission from the very, very, very deepest parts of it, I think we can rule out a spatial black hole, M2-6/15, and also in GX339-4, which is a very black candidate with a very similar line profile.
So you think we know the continuum in GX339-4 much, just as well as we know the GX639-4?
Not as well. But this is a point we can debate, but just. The current constraints, if you actually want to set a robust limit, if you actually want to set a formal limit on what the black hole spin is, I think we're limited by models of the plunge region. And it'd be nice for us to shrink that up a little bit. In terms of probing the astrophysics in the disk, we can ask a simple question whether what we see is not a formed disk. It's not. There may be good evidence for light bending from the from looking at that time variability, and we can also start confronting modifications in novel form disks. Now, the future to this is a little bit murky in how do we make much more progress than we're doing, given the current data, of course, ultimately still is more data-driven. But for example, starting to use some of the simulations that are now out there and starting to make predictions based on those, which we have modifications of this structure in naturally, that seems like a good way forward. So at that point, I'll stop there. Any other questions?
Could you say a word about the future of the field? That is, what time with what satellites will we get?
Sure. Yes. So there's these details of how we're interpreting the spectra, the absorption and all that. We'll learn lots about that in the very near future. Next month, the Japanese Space Agency will launch AstroLink 2. And that will have, for the first time, a very high spectral resolution calorimeter, which can get very nice data across the iron line band. We can look for, potentially, the forest of absorption lines that might be actually killing us. And if they're there, we can take them out. If they're not there, then it's great anyway. So that's the immediate future is that. The next huge step will be Constellation X and Zeus. Maybe a Constellation X slash Zeus, if they actually merge. That will be able to make a qualitative step by looking at line variability. A lot of the problems that I've been talking about now are degeneracies in the models, because when we're looking at these time average line profiles, we integrate over many, many, many orbital times of disk, essentially all we're doing is making a map of how much line emission is at a certain redshift. And we don't know how it got that redshift, whether it got that redshift by being in the plunge region, whether it got that redshift by being close to a spinning black hole. If you have the variability information, you can actually see a bright region in the turbulent disk on an orbit, then that just cuts through that degeneracy and lets you separate it out. The one dream, who knows whether we can actually achieve this, is to look for relativistic reverberation, which lets you look for an X-ray flare in the source. You can actually see the X-ray front sweep across the disk. And again, that is a very powerful way of taking out a lot of the degeneracies from these line profiles. So I mean, that's where we hope the future is going.
What's the spectral resolution proposed for Conex Zeus relative to AstroV2?
I'll let Chris say something about Zeus, but for ConX, it's going to be about AstroE, about twice as good as AstroE.
So good enough that you can usefully distinguish the absorption.
We 200 kilometers a second, something like that.
Yeah, about 200 kilometers a second. That was actually a very strong requirement that the scientists gave NASA in the AstroE.
Could do reverberation spectrally, remove enough of the degeneracy so you can get to the point of testing whether you were looking at anything like Kepler or this?
Yes, you should be able to. I mean, it's...
Right now you've got a lot of freedom removing sources and the emissivity profile and all those stuff around.
So I mean, right now, we just have to assume, we have to assume preparing, we have to assume GR. We can't use it as a test of GR. but with those extra piece of information, we actually show test variables, even not even from reverberation, but even from the dynamical time scale of probability, which is a lot easier than reverberation. And then, so as I would say, the dynamical time scale of probability will test issues like comparing the actual disk will help you separate out plunge region redshifts from other ridges, and then reverberation, if you can do it, you can start to push the test to GR.
In your final slides where you were showing the bits, you said that the reflection was ionized. How are you modeling the ionized reflection?
That's what the Valentine models.
Yeah, because I'd say that one of our current constraints is modeling ionized disks. We don't have wildly good reflection spectra from ionized disks. Well, David Valentine's ones are, I use them, they're the best we have. It obviously worries me very much when people use PEX ribbon and narrow line, because that's not going to cut it for an ionized disk.
We don't talk about that.
Yeah. Yeah. But I'd like to see a few more ionized disk models.
Yeah, I mean, Sergey Nyakshin made one, for example, and it's encouraging that they've done comparisons of that in the Valentine model. They're not too different. So there's a few out there, but I agree. You know, more models to compare up for always good. Chris,
So you continue to have shown that these are good diagnostics, really, really close to the hole. How far out do you think you're getting reasonable emission to use these iron lines as a diagnostic?
That's good. Then that really is a function of your spectral resolution. So you lose it at the point where the comparing velocity is equal to your resolution, pretty much. That's when you lose the ability to say anything. Right now, that's not the resolution is a very so you lose it. Use it at a compute file. It's maybe a few thousand RG. Astro-E, again, you can do a lot better. I mean, for example, we've got a project to look at NGC 4258, the Maser galaxy. And there, if the actual amazing disk is an X-ray source, if there's actually K-alpha lines coming from that, if you'll be able to see the double pump from that comparing disk. Because of the resolution. So as the resolutions get better, we'll be able to push the constraints further.
Oh, yeah, it's much bigger.
Yeah, it's much bigger.
Is it accurate to say that the line flux is not changing in FCG6?
No.
Okay.
It's just not changing in a way that's obviously correlated with the
but there are statistically significant changes.
Except at low velocities, is that right?
At low velocities, it does exactly what it should do. It's proportional to the power of the flux.
And at high luminosities, it's roughly constant.
So my personal, another idea for light bending is some kind of saturation due to ionization. When you start ionizing patches in your disk, then you lose your signal. That might start happening.
It's easier to look at all the other things to go out, and we are now talking about the source of the continuum coming from the base of the jet. How implausible is it that some of the emission could reflect outflows, clamped outflows or outflows, say, from the disk itself, which initially rotating and then starting?
So the actual emission could be the outflow.
The emission would be the outflow. I mean, so what you would call the reflection would be the features in the outflow. The ionizing it again from the chains of the jets to the ionizing regions.
I see it as
that. Coming up to this, which are also rotating and then acquiring it from
other sources. For most of the AGN, the disks, the lines that you infer are actually low ionization ion lines. So it's fluorescent emission, it's not recombination. So you need fairly cold and high column density material, which is why we always think of the disk set. If you're throwing dense clumps up, thin shot, you could do that. K can you produce your whole line profile from that? That becomes very problematic, and you expect to get very strong blue shifts from that. But yes, I mean,
except it, again, like you're calling, you can see something moving.
Yeah, but the
systematic blue shift, that's right.
But the fact your lines are always systematically redshifted is a point. That's quite powerful.
You still have the effect of gravitational redshift for a while.
Yeah, and trends are stopped for like an SS433, of course.
Yeah, that's much better. But just because you're looking at finer points now in the plunging region, so that's good.
I just would like to comment on the physics of the inner part of the disk, because we're talking about the accretion to the black hole, so I think it's worth mentioning that on the inner edge of the disk does not need to be at 6M. I mean, for very thin disk, yes, that's really correct. And one might think about using the argument or the characteristic of the accretion of the black hole that it should be transonic. So in fact, edge of the disk can be a little bit in the side.
Yeah, that's, that would be one example of the kind of things I think must be included in a new model for quantum. Right now we're assuming, you know, 6M mat spirals in. But you're right, you know, slim, you have to slim disks and slim disks.
It's supposed to be, it's called a Schwarzschild black hole. Something like Fokker will be needed.
That would be one, if you started trying to base some of these predictions off simulations, and you really start trying to handle